Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with attorney Jeff Frank to discuss a controversial Chicago ordinance used against political activists, which was recently ruled unconstitutional. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The internet was designed as an open system. Everyone with internet access can download and upload legal content of their choice without discrimination or interference. But according to a new report by Free Press, all that is about to change if internet service providers are allowed to use a technology called Deep Packet Inspection. Deep Packet Inspection, or DPI for short, allows internet service providers to probe internet traffic. They say they need DPI to secure their networks and minimize congestion on the net. But DPI can also be used to prioritize certain internet traffic, speed up or slow down applications, or target advertising to consumers based on electronic snooping. These uses violate net neutrality, the long-standing internet principle that keeps the internet open and free from discrimination. Last year, Comcast was caught using DPI to secretly block a file-sharing application called BitTorrent. Comcast claimed it was just managing congestion, but the FCC ruled that Comcast had violated net neutrality and forced the company to stop its practices. Comcast is no longer using DPI. Chris Riley, policy counsel of Free Press, said that Comcast's new practice isn't perfect, but it isn't violating net neutrality. He says ISPs like Cox that are claiming they need to manage congestion using DPI have ulterior motives. What they are really interested in, he says, is monetizing the internet.
They're trying to turn the internet into cable TV so that the certain uses of the internet are sped up, others are slowed down, and so that eventually they can move away from this flat fee per month for all-you-can-eat broadband. And they're disguising this attempt to turn the internet into cable television by pointing to growing congestion problems.
The scenario Riley talks about is bleak. Consumers paying more for access to less content and limited opportunity for new internet businesses to enter an increasingly closed and segmented market. If DPI isn't reined in, Riley predicts a balkanization of the entire internet, where applications and services will run differently on each network, kind of like the way cell phones and their networks operate today.
And so as the consumer, you will find this video site or this email service that you really like, and then you'll go from your home into your office and you'll be on a different internet service provider connection and it won't work the same.
Can the government legally spy on your computer data and communications? And what can you legally do to protect yourself against such intrusions on your privacy? Those are the two questions the Electronic Frontier Foundation set out to answer in their new guide, Surveillance Self-Defense. This is not paranoia. Consider the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program and the FBI's abuse of so-called national security letters to obtain records and other communications information. EFF has been holding training since 2005 in response to requests for education about how exactly people may be at risk for government spying. Kevin Bankston is a senior staff attorney.
In an age where anti-terrorist agents are infiltrating peace meetings of Quakers and other potentially at-risk organizations, those who serve minority populations, those who advance controversial political causes, they need to be informed and know how the law protects them and how they can use technology to protect themselves when the government wants to obtain their information.
Surveillance Self-Defense focuses on risks to three types of data: those stored on your computer, those being transmitted, and those stored by third parties, such as cable or phone companies. Solutions range from simply deleting unneeded files to encrypting email and using anonymizing tools for data that is stored with third parties. Bankston says even with the new administration in Washington, it's important to be well informed.
The powers that the government has to surveil are still quite broad and indeed have been expanded by new laws such as the USA Patriot Act back in 2001, the Protect America Act in 2007, and the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, such that the government has more legal power to spy on Americans than ever before.
Bankston says that changes to the laws will only come with citizen participation, and education about the laws is the first step towards meaningful participation.
Later this year, there are going to be debates over whether and how to extend portions of the Patriot Act that are expiring. Eventually, there will be reconsideration of this past summer's FISA Amendments Act, which broadly expanded the government's ability to wiretap in national security investigations. And so when those opportunities come, the citizenry needs to be ready. They need to know what these issues are and what's being debated.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Chicago will host the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment. Join representatives from 150 Justice, Peace, and Environment groups April 17th and 18th at People's Church, 941 West Lawrence Avenue. To learn more or register, visit icjpe.org or call 312-480-1331. Again, icjpe.org, 312-480-1331. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature an interview with attorney Jeff Frank to discuss a controversial Chicago ordinance used against political activists, which was recently ruled unconstitutional. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, March 21st, 2009. We are on the phone with Jeff Frank. Jeff Frank is an attorney with the Chicago chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and today we're going to talk with Jeff Frank about a recent Chicago disorderly conduct ordinance. Jeff Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
There have been some headlines on the internet and in recent coverage about a disorderly conduct ordinance and the fact that it recently has been apparently ruled down by a U.S. district judge. Let's start at the beginning here. What is this ordinance and what was the point of the ordinance?
Well, the ordinance it's a provision of the Chicago Disorderly Conduct Ordinance. This is a part of the Chicago Municipal Ordinances. And the city itself has a disorderly conduct ordinance, and there are multiple sections to that ordinance, and what we specifically were challenging was subsection D. The ordinance, for those who care to look it up, is Municipal Code Section 8-4-010, and like I said, the provision which was struck down is subsection D. This provision defines disorderly conduct when a person knowingly, and here's the part, that it fails to obey a lawful order of dispersal by a police officer, I'm shortening it here, where three or more persons are committing acts of disorderly conduct in the immediate vicinity, which acts are likely to cause substantial harm or serious inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm. And that has been the subsection which has been used at least over the last several years, and you can go back even to 1968 when a predecessor provision was used to order the dispersal of anti-war protesters and subsequently those arresting those who failed to disperse. I can't tell you what was in the minds of the council when they enacted it. I have done some legislative history going back, and I don't know for sure why this is in there, but this appears to be, from my examination, the only place where a police officer can order a group of individuals to disperse. There was another ordinance on the books in the 1990s called the Gang Loitering Ordinance, in which the police also had the power to order a group to disperse under specified conditions. That ordinance was also held to be unconstitutional, and that all went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, which, by a plurality opinion, was held to be unconstitutional.
It would seem, though, that, well, it basically addresses matters pertaining to disorderly conduct, which it seems like is pretty vague. The definition you had basically described is what the law says is specifically disorderly conduct.
Well, what it says, that's one of the problems with the ordinance, and one of the reasons the judge struck it down as being vague. There are several other provisions, parts of the disorderly conduct ordinance. For example, doing an act which would provoke or aid in the making of a breach of the peace, or uttering an offensive utterance, gesture, display to provoke a breach of the peace, public intoxication, for example. Those are disorderly conduct. Now, the courts over time have said, you know, disorderly conduct, particularly this concept of breach of the peace, is vague, but it's sort of intended to be. But this is different. Subsection D classifies as disorderly conduct a breach in a situation where someone is undertaking a completely lawful activity, but other persons near the individual are committing acts of disorderly conduct. So there's sort of an initial finding that some other people are committing acts of disorderly conduct before there can be a dispersal, and then you refuse to disperse, and then you are arrested for disorderly conduct on your own. So it's an infraction within an infraction. And we have argued this in various venues in the city, and this happens to be the first time a judge has understood that our analysis of this and found it to be correct.
The reason that I wanted to discuss this is particularly with regards to not just the fact about disorderly conduct in general, but that it seems like that the application of this law is particularly targeted toward political activists who might engage in constitutionally protected rights of free speech and assembly, guaranteed under the Bill of Rights and under the Constitution, that this ordinance is intended to basically try to diffuse. Is that a correct reading of that assessment?
I can't say that the ordinance was created for that purpose. I can say that it's been used for that purpose, but I can't say that it was created for that purpose. This ordinance is used in a lot of other circumstances other than First Amendment situations, and it isn't necessarily unconstitutional under those circumstances. But the fact is that it has been used, and we can assume it's been used consciously by the Chicago police as a way of breaking up legally constituted assemblies.
And that could mean me and two friends just hanging out with a bar, maybe being a little bit boisterous. It could also mean, as was the case in 1968, tens of thousands of people protesting the Democratic National Convention.
It could, although in the first application, you and a few friends hanging out, that would be more of like the gang loitering ordinance type situation. But, you know, if you weren't exercising First Amendment rights necessarily, in other words, assemble to petition the government for redress of your grievances, or assemble to make a speech, for example, on a street corner. Yes, if they come and there's an assembly like that on a street corner, for example, where somebody has literally gotten up on a soapbox and says, I don't like what's going on, I don't like the law, I don't like the new parking regulations, and it's used to break that up, then in fact it is being used to thwart your legitimate First Amendment rights.
I'd like to talk a little bit now about not just the ordinance, but the fact that this got struck down. And I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the history of how it got struck down. There was apparently a protest in 2006 at the Taste of Chicago, where this became a capstone. Can you discuss this a bit, please?
Just so you understand, we've challenged this ordinance, like I said, in a number of different courts in the city, and we challenged it for prior arrests prior that were made prior to the 2006 arrests, particularly the arrests at Okun, Michigan in 2005. We challenged it in the Circuit Court of Municipal County. Those are now, in fact, being challenged in federal court also, and we'll see what happens with this, with how the other federal courts, federal judges, I should say, in the Northern District of Illinois look at this ruling by this judge. But yes, the specific case, there was actually seven people arrested, six of them arrested under this ordinance for leafleting and talking to individuals who were in and around the Army, it wasn't just Army, I guess it's the Joint Military Recruiting Booth at the Taste of Chicago in July of 2006. There were several individuals who were there to hand out information to those who were in line or seeking information from the military about enlisting, as to reasons, you know, not to enlist, to make sure you're aware of the facts of enlistment, and this has been part of an ongoing campaign to apprise the youth of Chicago and the Chicago area of their alternatives to military service, in terms of an education or training, as well as the downside of enlistment. Rather conducted through the auspices of the American Friends Service Committee program on military recruiting and alternatives for youth.
And so you saw these protesters were trying to hand out flyers. They were arrested and charged under this. And then you basically, and maybe I'm smearing the sequence of events here, but it might be but then you and others had filed suit against the ordinance, deeming it unconstitutional.
What happened was, I mean, just as a predecessor, they were arrested, and the cases were ultimately dismissed. But they weren't dismissed. They were dismissed because the city failed to prosecute. They kept asking for continuances on the court date, and finally we told the judge, this is ridiculous. You know, either the city and the police, this is the police witnesses, the arresting officers weren't showing up in court. And the court said, we agree, this is ridiculous, and dismissed it. Subsequent to that, four of those arrested under this ordinance filed suit, but not making the constitutional claim, and went forth in a federal court with the city. But two of the defendants, Don Goldhammer and Robin Shermer, decided that they would like to make a constitutional issue out of this, and we agreed to help them. It was not just myself; it's Charlie Newsom Sabat, also of the National Lawyers Guild, Kurt Feuer, an attorney at law, and Elizabeth Wang, who was with the law firm of Lovey and Lovey. So there was four of us who decided to assist Don and Robin in the suit.
Mm-hmm. And so now, in the past week, on March 13th, the ruling comes down from, well, let me actually just read an excerpt from the press release. U.S. District Judge John Grady ruled on Friday, March 13th, that a significant part of the Chicago Disorderly Conduct Ordinance was an unconstitutional violation of freedom of expression guaranteed by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Police have repeatedly used the ordinance to harass anti-war protesters. So let's talk about what could happen now regarding the future of this. I'd like to talk about some of the, I guess, future possibilities of the fate of this ordinance and of issue. First question might be, and this might reflect maybe a little bit of ignorance on my part, in which case I'd be more than happy to be informed otherwise. Could there be an appeal?
Yes, yes. Going forward, I mean, there's still this. This was just one part, although the major part of the lawsuit that we filed against the city and the Chicago Police Department. The judge found the ordinance to be unconstitutional, which in a sense settled a big part of the suit, but not all of it. There are other claims which we made for false arrest, false imprisonment, and there's a claim which is known generically as Monell claims, that after a case in which we're saying that the city has a pattern and practice of suppressing free speech. The judge fully expects that we'll settle these other non-constitutional claims, and we probably will with the city, and then go forward and decide what to do. We are going to ask that the judge issue an injunction, it'll probably be a temporary injunction at least, but an injunction against the city using this ordinance on a going forward basis. I can't tell you whether the judge will grant it or not, but certainly we believe the city will appeal this ruling. They appealed the gang loitering ordinance all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and kept losing. So the next step would be, if the city decides to appeal, they would appeal it to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is located or headquartered here in Chicago. And they would file that appeal. Whether he grants the injunction or not, that we think they're likely to appeal. If he grants the injunction, they'll probably appeal more rapidly, which is fine with us, because if we'd soon get it before the Seventh Circuit and present our case.
Maybe I'm, again, a matter of, I guess, ignorance regarding law and legal procedure here. Why would a temporary injunction be needed if the law has already been struck down?
Well, this judge has struck down the ordinance. So essentially, it means that in his view, the ordinance is unconstitutional. Another judge in this district could find the ordinance constitutional. And then you have a conflict, which means for sure it'd go to the Seventh Circuit, or they'd look at it. Seventh Circuit has to take any appeal. It's not like the Supreme Court where they can pick or choose. Therefore, it's not necessarily until he would issue an injunction, the police could keep using it, saying, "Well, this guy found it unconstitutional. We don't believe it is."
I see.
This judge. So that's why, you know, if he doesn't grant the injunction, you know, whether they appeal or not, the most likely will appeal, because we will argue then every case that comes up, every time there's an arrest under this, we will argue that the case has to be thrown out, because there is a judge that's found it unconstitutional, and there's no conflict at this point. There's no federal judge that has upheld it. So at this point, it can be used to get dismissals, and the circuit court judges here in Cook County, at least in the Northern District of Illinois, will most likely, not to say they won't totally, but most likely will dismiss any cases that are where somebody's arrested under this ordinance.
The hope would be, let's look at a kind of optimistic scenario. Let's say that a temporary injunction is granted. In fact, it's entirely possible that maybe whatever future appeals that might happen with regards to this particular ordinance might fail, as they've done in other particular laws pertaining to freedom of speech and assembly in Chicago on behalf of political activists, or for that matter, anyone. You would hope that the realm of freedom of speech and assembly would be improved in Chicago as a result of that fact. What do you think would be the impact of a day-to-day political activist or demonstrator or protester in light of this, in maybe the best-case scenario here?
Well, assuming it's appealed and is upheld, or an injunction is issued, then this ordinance can no longer be used, or this part of this ordinance can no longer be used to arrest folks who, you know, there is no other mechanism by which a lawful assembly can be broken up. In other words, and people arrested who refuse to leave. That doesn't mean that there won't be other provisions where the police will try to arrest people. But this has been other than things like blocking traffic, blocking that sort of thing. You know, if in fact there's an assembly and it's not blocking traffic, it's not blocking the sidewalk, and you know, like a standard sort of picket line, this cannot be used. This ordinance will no longer be able to be used because it's unconstitutional to arrest people. So yes, I think it will enhance folks' ability. Because just to be clear, this ordinance could be used to disperse an assembly that has even an assembly that has a permit, and that's why the judge found it unconstitutional. Because you could have an assembly under this ordinance that has a permit, is within the confines of its permit, has nothing going on, and there could be three people from a right-wing group making a ruckus, and that would allow the police to order a dispersal. Well, and that's why the judge, that's known as a heckler's veto, and the judge was very concerned that that's how this ordinance could be used to thwart legitimate First Amendment activity. So I think it will enhance people's ability to assemble lawfully under the First Amendment and exercise their freedom of expression and assembly.
And that's always all to the good, I think. Another kind of legal-ish question. Could the city council or the mayor or whoever would, the various bodies that affect ordinances that affect the city of Chicago, could they write another law to take its place, or is that just utterly forbidden as a result of this?
They could write another law to take its place, but they would have to correct the unconstitutional infirmity. And I'm not 100% sure how they would do that in this circumstance. Now, they did, after the gang loitering ordinance was found unconstitutional, the city council did go back and enact a new one that allegedly corrected what the Supreme Court found to be unconstitutional about the original ordinance. So they could come back and also have a dispersal, but it couldn't be this way. It couldn't be where there's a lawful assembly and somebody else is causing a problem as a mechanism to issue an order to disperse. But that's not to say they won't try, or they won't try to tweak it just a little and hope to go through a whole other round of this in federal court.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my last question on this set of affairs, I'd like to, and I don't know if you'll be in position to answer, but I'll ask the question anyway. Look through your crystal ball for a second. What do you foresee as the future for this particular ordinance and for matters pertaining to matters of free speech and assembly that the ordinance tries to address in some respect? Where do you think we go from here?
I don't know this federal judge very well. I'm told he's considered to be a fairly conservative judge, so that bodes well for us in terms of an appeal to the Seventh Circuit, because if a judge, which the Seventh Circuit recognizes as being fairly conservative, but still found this to be an unconstitutional inhibition on free expression, they will take it more seriously than, quite honestly, if it's a judge who's known to be a liberal had found it to be unconstitutional. So I think in terms of the Seventh Circuit, we think the law is pretty good, pretty substantially behind us. Not to say that, you know, there you won't, not, you know, it's still, you know, subject to, of course, their interpretation. In terms of whether we'll get an injunction or not, I'm less optimistic. So in the near future, if anybody's arrested under this ordinance, then the person, the defendant, can claimed that the, you know, a federal judge has found to be unconstitutional, and you need to dismiss the charges because you can't be arrested under an unconstitutional ordinance. And I think folks should get a dismissal. Now, you still have to go through the pain of being arrested. The assembly is still broken up. All the bad things that happen from an arrest are still exist. And for those who don't want to risk arrest, of course, then their assembly, their constitutionally ordained assembly is broken up, and the protest would be over. I can't tell you, because I'm not privy to the inner workings of the police department and the corporation council as to how they view this. It came down a week ago, and we'll be having talks with them in the next couple of days to settle the rest of it, and we'll see sort of their attitude on their defeat on the ordinance. And maybe they'll say, okay, we understand, we won't try to use this until it's settled at the Seventh Circuit. We think we'll win at the Seventh Circuit. Maybe they'll say, tough, we're going to go ahead and keep using it because it works for us if they use it, whether it's constitutional or not.
We've been speaking with Jeff Frank, an attorney with the Chicago chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, who's been speaking with us about a recent unconstitutionally ruled ordinance in Chicago, the Chicago Disorderly Conduct Ordinance, that's been used particularly against political activists and demonstrators in Chicago. Jeff Frank, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Just for those who are legal wonks, the memorandum opinion is posted on the Indy Media website, so anybody who wants to read it and is welcome to do so.
That was an interview with Jeff Frank, recorded on March 21st, 2009. The court ruling surrounding Chicago's Disorderly Conduct Ordinance is available on Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indymedia.org. Indie Media is spelled INDYMEDIA. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.